domino, on the spot a few black for hands, domino, domino, on the spot a few black for hands.
Hello everyone, what's happening? I'm your host, Robert Stevens, and this is the Black Work Experience Podcast. This is our second episode, and I am overjoyed by the response to our first episode. Many of you reached out via email, text, Instagram, social media, and said, like, this is so needed. So I'm happy to be able to provide you all with the content that you need. As you may know, I started this podcast because I was tired of being the only black male or one of the few black people at my organizations. This can be crazy. I was constantly called upon to speak for the black experience or expected to do the emotional labor after blatantly racist things occurred. This is heavy, and it left me feeling fragile, unseen, unappreciated, and definitely in need of a change. I began to ask my friends if they've ever experienced being the only one or one of the few people of color at their jobs and the impact it had upon them. We discussed what it felt like to experience microaggressions and not have a friend or ally to lean on. Balancing the thin line between needing your coins and not being tokenized is never easy. But guess what? You have us now, and we will always have your back. The Black Work Experience Podcast explores the intersection between race, class, and privilege in America and in the workforce. We tell the stories of those who paved and are currently paving the way. As people of color gain more institutional, political, and economic power, we often find ourselves surrounded by people who do not look like us, talk like us, or even think like us. This podcast discusses what it's like to walk in the shoes of those who feel alone. I fully recognize that not all black people think alike. The stories we share on this podcast may seem foreign to you and your experience, but rest assured, bucko, a lot of black people experience microaggressions daily, and we need an outlet. This is your outlet. You all are not alone, and guess what? We got your back. This podcast is for all people, but we focus heavily on black people. I want you to know that you're not the only one experiencing microaggressions, otherness, and potential loneliness at work. If you identify with majority culture, listen to this podcast. Think about how you can help your black colleagues when your coworker talks over them, when your coworker runs to the manager instead of having a difficult conversation with that black person, or calls them intimidating or hostile. We need you all in this work. We need everyone in this work. But guess what time it is? All right, you guessed it. It's mail time. We had a lot of submissions this week for mail time. I need you all to keep them coming. You can send it to us on our social media. Find us on Instagram, BWEP Pod. Find us anywhere. You can send it to us via social media, Black Work Experience, Google us, find us. Send it to us on our Gmail, blackworkexperiencepod@gmail.com. We want to hear from you. I need these stories. They keep us grounded. This week's submission comes from Jasmine in Maryland. Oh, glory. Let's get ready. Jasmine says, I am from a small town in Tennessee and went to college in a small town in the South. When I moved to D.C., that was the first time I really saw a mass of homeless people. While walking to my building one morning, I stopped and engaged the homeless people in conversation. I decided to give them money as I was moved by their story. After about 10 minutes of conversation, I entered my building and was stopped by a white woman who worked there. Oh, glory. We know it's about to happen. She told me I could not enter the building because they had a no solicitation policy and their bathrooms were for people who work there. I was shocked and realized she must have saw me talking to the homeless people and assumed I didn't belong here. I was a new employee, but I was about to show my ass. Go ahead, Jasmine, talk to her. This is getting interesting. The white woman told me I had to show some proof that I worked there or leave. If I didn't leave, she was going to call the police. I thought about it and calmly told the woman to get the hell out of my way before I give them a reason to call the ambulance. She turned around, red, and walked away. I heard her dialing 911, but I smiled at her as I used my company-issue fob to get on the elevator and get to my office. I can't wait to see her again. Oh, man, wow. Y'all, this is heavy. This is super heavy. Reading this, I mean, I just need to be realistic and think about what time we're in. We just had that situation with Amy Cooper happen over Memorial Day weekend in Central Park. Many of you probably saw the video, and I think that this is super similar. Just like the gall that this lady at your job had to think that she can control and, like, she knew her privilege associated with knowing, like, who is there, who belongs in the building. To me, it's similar. It's similar to Amy Cooper just saying, hey, for those of you who don't know, I'm going to give you a brief rundown. Amy Cooper is in Central Park, and Kristen Cooper, no relation, is also there. He's a bird watcher. And this particular portion of Central Park, you are supposed to keep your dog on a leash. Her dog is running wild. He, you know, says to her, hey, can you put your dog on a leash? And she takes offense to it and apparently says, no, I'm not. And, you know, he starts recording her. I think he understood that this situation could get very, very volatile. And so she, you know, walks up to him, puts her hand in her face and says, hey, you know, you can't tell me what to do. Don't record me. Matter of fact, I'm going to call the police. And Amy Cooper proceeds to call the police and in a high-pitched, like, voice begin to say, oh, she says, no, she tells him first, I'm going to call the police and tell them an African-American man is threatening me. And so she calls the police and, like, you know, begins this sob story where, oh, I'm being threatened. My life and my dog's life is being threatened by this African-American man. And, man, luckily, Kristen had the wherewithal to record it. And his sister places it on social media. And within a day or two, Amy Cooper, she loses her job. So she was a vice president at a financial institution. She lost her job. The dog was ordered to be sent back to the shelter where she got it from, the rescue shelter. And, like, it's just a mess. But, I mean, I think, unfortunately, there are just a lot of white Amy Coopers at the organizations we work in. And I know without a shadow of a doubt that, you know, there are a lot of Christians. And I think that there are a lot of individuals who confronted you, Jasmine. We have to be careful. I mean, white women have used the long arm of the law against black people for a long time. And I don't think it's going to change. But we have to begin to demand change. And I think Amy losing her job is a good first step. We got to learn how to take up space, you all. And so I encourage you to continue to do that. I think that this is an amazing transition to introduce our guest on today's episode, who knows a lot about being a black woman and taking up space in white-dominated areas. So with that being said, I am excited and honored to have Efi Walker, who's the founder and chief talent officer of OFER, which is a talent matching company that connects top talent to education reform organizations all across the country. She is also the author of Dear Black Woman on LinkedIn. You all, if you're not familiar with Dear Black Woman, no, I was going to tell you to stop what you're doing. Don't stop because I need you to keep listening to this podcast. After this podcast is over, I need you to go to LinkedIn and type in hashtag Dear Black Woman, and you need to check it out because, I mean, she routinely speaks truth to power in a very realistic way. Thank you for joining us today.
Let us introduce our guest. This is Efi Walker. Now, she is the founder and chief talent matchmaker at the OFER Walker Group. Now, this group is a talent matchmaking firm that connects top talent to education reform organizations all across the country. She is also the author of Dear Black Women on LinkedIn. And if you are not familiar with Dear Black Women on LinkedIn, you need to do yourself a favor and every black woman you know a favor and get into this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Efi, thank you so much for joining us. Well, my name is Naomi. I am the director of a large nonprofit that focuses on education. Specifically, my role is focused on K-12 education, so I'm extremely happy to have you here. So, Efi, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. We're honored to have you on the podcast. And so I think we're going to let Robert kick off with some questions because I'm going to have to do deep dive, woman to woman.
All right.
Wonderful.
Well, let's just jump into it. Like, you know, let's get started with a typical question. You know, who are you? Tell us a little bit about yourself, your life journey, and what you're doing these days.
That's great. Well, both of you, thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here. So
In terms of my story, so I grew up in Wisconsin, middle of nowhere, Wisconsin. I'm the oldest of six children. My parents are Nigerian immigrants. And, you know, Robert, as you sort of shared, talking about being the only, that was my experience from a very young age. I was one of three African-American kids in my school. The other two are my brothers, so that made for a very interesting sort of experience. But I had really strong teachers who, you know, pushed me, and they didn't care that we were poor. They didn't care that we didn't have a lot, that my parents had a funny accent. None of those things mattered. And then fast forward to college, where it was the first time I had my intellect question and also my integrity question. I had a professor who pulled me aside after grading our organic chemistry exam and told me that he did not think I was capable of earning the grade that I had literally worked my tail off for. And that was the first sort of massive confrontation with sort of the soft bigotry of low expectations. And I was pretty devastated. And I thought I was going to be the next Johnny Cochran of the world. I was going to go to law school. And then I saw this sign that said, so do you want to change the world? And it was Teach for America. So I taught in Philadelphia, had a tremendous experience with kids who could have easily been me or my siblings if my parents had moved somewhere else. Then, you know, went off to law school, came back, spent a couple of years opening new offices for this national organization. And during that time, that's when I was really struck by the fact that there were so few leaders of color in leadership. And I was stunned by the reality of week after week walking into boardrooms, walking into places of power where decisions were being made about young people, and I'd be the only one, the only woman, the only person of color. And when I would every once in a while get the courage enough to ask, why is this? The answers were really underwhelming for me, and they did not comport with what I knew to be true, and, you know, the truth of genius being equally distributed, access not being, and the answers I received did not jive with that. So when I'd completed my time there, I set off to start a national talent matchmaking firm to work with historically white institutions to ensure that there were more leaders of color in the corner office so that when my two children ask me 20 years from now, what did you do during this time? You know, what were you up to? I need to be able to give them an answer that matters. And so that's really the work that I'm engaging in right now.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that is paramount. And I just want to go on record as saying that I was just in Philly last week. I'm an Eagles fan. I don't know if you are an Eagles fan, but I want to let you know that I am a huge Eagles fan, so we may share that connection.
Right, right.
That's great.
And so thank you for walking us through, like, how you decided not only professionally but personally why this mattered so much to you. And just wanting to, you know, we understand how, like, your racial identity has impacted your professional career, but can you walk us through, because we want to make sure that people have an understanding of, like, their issues or the challenges that they face, they're not alone. Walk us through a few more of the challenges that you faced in your day-to-day work recently.
So, you know, what's interesting in the work that I do, I have the honor and privilege of sitting at, you know, literally sitting in boardrooms, sitting next to CEOs and to board members and other folks who are making decisions about who will lead organizations that, you know, for lack of a better, you know, turn of phrase, they make the weather. And I, you know, our team has access to how individuals are making those decisions. And so one of the things that actually, in terms of challenges, that led to the writing of Dear Black Women was I had a front row seat to the challenges that leaders of color were facing, oftentimes unbeknownst to them. So what do I mean by that? It means that there would be top candidates, and I would be in a decision meeting with members of a selection committee who were vetting a candidate, discussing a candidate's potential, and I would hear things like, Naomi's too smart. I'd hear things like, Robert's not articulate enough. I'd hear things like, Efi probably, she just isn't ready, with no evidence, nothing sort of grounding any of these comments and seeing other folks sort of get a pass and feeling as though there was this wide disconnect between what people, what we've been told that we need to do, that you need to work twice as hard, that you need to check all the boxes, you need to jump through all the hoops. But when in actuality, when it was coming down to actually making a decision, none of those things were none of those things actually mattered. If you went to an Ivy League school, sometimes that would actually be used against you. Someone might say, did you hear how Efi mentioned she went to Harvard two times? Totally negating the fact that they'd actually asked you about your collegiate experience and asked you those questions. And so it felt as though there was this game of you're damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Damned if you don't,
and what
right.
was
like,
most painful. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you saying it is you being pretentious, but them asking means they want to know whether or not you fit into the box that they want to check.
Exactly, exactly. And so what was the struggle for me was that I would also be on the other end hearing from countless leaders of color who were rightfully so frustrated, experiences of going through interview after interview. And these are very, very successful individuals, very senior leaders, 6 months, 9 months, sometimes 12 months, sometimes longer, of jumping through hoops only to be told at the very end, nope, sorry, you're not it, and asking themselves, why? What have I done wrong? And I, as someone who'd actually seen and been sitting at this table, felt a deep need to tell people, it's not you. It's not. It's actually not you. It's actually not you. This is the world that we. This is the world that we live in. Here are the experiences that you might face. It might take you twice as long to find a job, even though it shouldn't. You might find out that someone who is less qualified, who had fewer degrees, got the job, even though you've graduated with a law degree, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It is very real that after you state your salary requirements, that you will be offered $30,000 to $40,000 less once they determine that their finalist, that their candidate of choice, is a leader of color. It's not because you weren't clear about your exposition on the front end. This is happening over and over, and we are seeing it on the back end. And the response to that was really powerful because it let people know, to your point, and I think the reason why you all are, doing this podcast is to let people know that they're not alone and that they're not crazy. They're not crazy. That you're not making this up. You're not blowing things out of proportion. This is actually happening to you, and it's happening to a lot of others as well.
You're not feeling the type of way. This is actually happening, right? And so
exactly.
Black woman to black woman have to get into Dear Black Woman, have to. I've looked at one of your posts recently, and you have a series of steps, a series of things that women should be thinking about, and I think of that as like what our inner ruminations are every single day. But they're usually not about your professional trajectory. They're about like what you wear, how you wear your hair, what you say in particular settings, how you carry yourself. And it's really interesting that you break down some things that a lot of women don't even think about when they're going to a job interview or when they walk into an office building every day. So, going into an interview and going through a process and telling women, you should not tell them how much you make now. You should tell them what your salary, your requirements are. Thinking about, black women are paid 60 cents for every dollar a white man makes for the same job. We've started to see this issue really rise to the top of discussion thanks to Twitter and other social media platforms. But can you walk through, what was it? What was the impetus of you creating this letter to other black women? How did you decide that this is what you wanted to do?
Well, I essentially had to ask myself a series of questions, and some of those questions centered around this idea of it's easy to be a problem spotter. So if all I was going to do was be a problem spotter, somebody else could do that. Somebody else could be a problem spotter.
Mm-hmm.
But what I wanted to do was to say, okay, so if we see these problems, so what can we do about it? What can we do about it? Do I just throw my hands up in the air and say, well, this is terrible, and commiserate with our girlfriends or with our spouses, et cetera? That didn't seem to be sufficient. And so what I decided to do was to say, here's sort of the guide for what you can do that you just may not, you may not have given yourself permission to do these things. You know, I talked to someone today who, this really successful, young African-American, super successful, and we chatted today, and, you know, he's thinking about what could be next, and I said to him, so tell me, what are your salary expectations? And this gentleman has, he has done so much. I thought I was going to hear this very strong, very assertive, here's my number, really high number. And instead what I heard was, well, you know, no one gets into education for the money. You know, I never thought I'd be making as much as I'm making right now. So I don't want to make any less. And I just let him keep talking. And by the end of his talking, again, this is just him talking, he had talked himself down from the number he was already at. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, can I give you some unsolicited advice? And he said, absolutely. I said, never again. So let me walk you through right now. You need to have your number, and you need to own that number. Your number actually needs to be $40,000 higher than what you just said right now. No one actually needs to know. It's okay that you told me, as someone who's going to be advocating for you, et cetera. You don't tell anyone else at any part of the interview process what you're making now. It is absolutely irrelevant. He asked me some really smart questions around, well, what if somebody does ask me my salary? How do I tap dance around that? What do I do if I'm in a state where it's not illegal to do that at this point? I gave him some pointers on that, redirecting the conversation back to what your expectations are and how to just hold firm and how to use silence to his advantage. You don't have to explain yourself. You can give a number and stop talking. And so that interaction of also hearing how other people have done it, hearing that it's actually okay, gave him permission. He literally said, I didn't know I could do that. And I see white leaders do this all the time. And they are directing their process through, you know, whether it's an interview process, et cetera, not the other way around. And so I wanted to give insight into how we have to start giving ourselves permission to just demand more, and also at the same time recognizing that it is real that there will sometimes be negative backlash to that. And so part of what I was also trying to do is to say it's unfair, but there's also a way that you can ask that might make it more likely that you will get what you want. It may be different than the way a white woman is asking. It might be different than the way a white man is asking. That is unfair. But if the goal is to get to this outcome, I want you to understand the different ways that you can navigate. You choose. It's up to you. It's not for me to determine what is required for you to feel human and that your humanity is intact. But I want to give you multiple options from which you can choose from and understand the consequences of each. Does that make sense?
No, that makes perfect sense.
Absolutely.
I mean, so let me, I want to talk to you about that, because do you think students in schools, this is something that we should be teaching in like senior seminar class? Because I thought about all that I learned in college, fully transparent. I attended an HBCU, Winston-Salem State University for undergrad, and George Mason University for graduate school. But I never learned about how to negotiate my salary, how to have these conversations. And I think that in other communities, this is a commonplace thing, something that they learn, you know, quite often, to always negotiate your salary or ask for more. You know, I have the opportunity to speak to women and men of color about things of this nature, and I was surprised at how often we do not negotiate our salary. So what do you think, how do you think we could change this? I know you're a change maker and you're making change. What could we do to, like, do this on a wide scale level, larger level?
So first I will say that I do think universally at a collegiate level, that skill is not being taught. So I went to a historically white institution, the University of Wisconsin. I was not taught that either. However, when I was in graduate school, there was an African-American professor who was there, and I was applying for jobs, and I said, I don't know what, so when I get an offer, what do I do? What do I do? And so she walked me through her first experience of negotiating, and she's the one who told, I mean, she didn't tell me in terms of the pay gap, but she said, you go in and you figure out your research, write down exactly what you're going to say. If you have to post it to your laptop so that you say the words, that you force the words to come out of your mouth, then that's what you need to do. And I was in my early 20s at this point. So my point in all of this, to answer your question, one, ask. Just asking someone else already increases your chances of getting more. So just number one, you need to ask. Number two, Robert, you're asking about college. I, as a mother, I have two young children, I have a 5-year-old and a 4-year-old. I actually think that a lot of this, where in terms of where we need to learn about how to do this, actually starts much earlier in terms of how we are talking to our kids. So I grew up, and I, you know, I don't presume to know how you all grew up, but I grew up in a, you know, fantastic parents who sacrifice, et cetera, et cetera. However, I also grew up in a very much, this is what I told you to do, you should go do it world. Yes.
Right.
The way that my children are being raised right now, while it is very frustrating in a lot of instances, they question. They know they have a right to question. Last year, my 4-year-old son, his teacher was, you know, meting out a consequence to a student and was telling the student, you know, you're in trouble for this, you have a timeout or whatever the consequence was. And he said to the teacher, Miss X, I think you could use a nicer tone and my friend would still listen to you. And he was four.
Mm-hmm.
And she had to have a conversation with them. So, you know, like the way that I'm talking, he said, yes, I think you could use a nicer voice. He'll still listen to you. She taught, you know, had to walk him through what are consequences, et cetera, et cetera. But she had to reason with him, and he felt completely empowered and entitled to demand better and respect from an adult. And then this year, my daughter, who now he's 5, she's 4, has the same teacher. And she came home one day and she said, a teacher yelled at me or something happened. And he said, well, you have to stand up for yourself. And he practiced on the way to school in the car. He is giving her tips on what to say, how to say it, when to say it. Actually told her that it's better off to, you're better off doing it in the beginning of the school year because then teachers know that you're serious. He's 5. And so I say that to say that is I would have never dreamed of speaking to a teacher in that way or feeling like I had the sort of agency at that age to say I deserve respect too, and I'm going to say it in a respectful way, and I'm going to coach myself and learn from my parents in terms of how I can talk to a teacher so that he or she will listen to me. We have to start, I believe, teaching our kids to do that, so that it just becomes normal. Like to him right now, it is normal.
That's normal.
To plan a conversation.
Normal.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
And I would see that as him replicating what he sees at home, right? And
right.
The idea of he's hearing the conversations or the work that you and your husband both do in terms of coaching people and coming up with strategy, he's hearing that, and that language is normal to him. What would you tell the younger sister, the daughter of someone who doesn't have the autonomy or they don't have the best understanding of what it means to advocate for yourself?
So again, I would give the advice of asking. So I think we underestimate the value of just practice. So in some ways, it's honestly not any more complicated than that. And the way I think about it is it's a muscle. So there have been plenty of times where, you know, I might say, I don't want to do this thing. I know I should advocate in this way. I don't want to do it. And reminding yourself of why you're doing it. So there are times I have to remind myself, okay, this is why I'm doing it. And that sort of gives you the cape of courage to go and do this thing that is uncomfortable. And the more you do it, like a muscle, it becomes more natural as you continue to do it over and over. So the advice I would give is to say, talk to a friend, ask someone else, here's the situation, what do you think I should do? Role play that situation. I role play countless situations with my husband, with other colleagues, part of my kitchen cabinet. People call me so that they can role play things. I do that with my team. Obviously, you see that my kids do it. I role play with my kids. If there's something going on, I might say, okay, how do you want to talk to your friend about this? Let's practice. I'll be the friend. We do that right now, and that's part of the reason why then they're able to then go and practice those skills in real life and then come back and debrief. So how did that go? So you had to talk to a friend about not, you know, telling you that you can't play on this playground. How did it go when you had a conversation with him? How did that go? And so it doesn't even have to be about salary at this age, because it wouldn't in middle school or whatever, but it's the idea of negotiation. That's the essential skill, and getting comfortable asking for what you want and expecting that you will actually get it.
Yeah. No, I think that's amazing. I wanna talk a little bit about another one of the series that you penned, and it's Black Women at Work. Specifically this one. I'm gonna read a little excerpt from it. And I wanna make sure I pronounce his name correctly. Is it Amara?
Oh, that's my daughter, Amara. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So, dear Amara, mommy's friend, a fellow black executive, was recently told that her hair was unprofessional. Her boss included hair as an area of growth in her performance review. Her boss is white. Mommy's friend sat her boss down and said, I see plenty of white women coming to work with wet hair. I see plenty of white women coming to work with uncombed hair, fresh from yoga. I see white women with purple streaks in their hair. I do not know anyone born with purple hair. I've seen white women come to work with short hair, mohawks, and everything in between. Have you told them that their hair is unprofessional? No. Okay, so let me explain a few things to you. Number one, my hair grows out of my head this way. My hair is black. My hair is combed. My hair is clean. It is unprofessional for you to tell me that the way my hair grows out of my head is unprofessional. When I read that, I was taken back to conversations that I've enjoyed with my wife, and she explained to me that sometimes, you know, this may be a commonplace thing for her at her job. So how much of what you do is dismantling systemic racism and inequity? How do you gel with that? Do you see yourself as a dismantler?
Absolutely. So a lot of the work, so we work obviously with potential candidates, with individuals, et cetera, but a lot of our work is with the organization and helping them implement bias disruptors. And so you're using language in terms of dismantling. We use language in terms of disrupting bias and coaching organizations on how to do it. So sometimes it is as simple as saying, okay, when you've evaluated this person, ask yourself what you would do if Efi were white. And just forcing people to just say, okay, if these words were coming out of the white candidate had said that, what would my reaction be? And plenty of other things in between that we're trying to do in terms of implementing those disruptors. At the same time, being very real with individuals about how they may be perceived. And again, it all comes down to a matter of choice. So for example, one of my earliest jobs, I intentionally wore my hair natural to my interview with the CEO. And I typically wear braids, but I intentionally wore an afro because I said, well, begin as you mean to go on. So if this is not going to work, we're going to know it today. And I got hired. And I wore my hair braided for the 2.5 years I worked at this organization. But my point is, you have to decide. It's not a judgment in terms of, I don't believe in these sort of, you know, sometimes these internal wars that we have of, you know, you should do this or you should do that. You've got to decide for yourself what is required to continue to keep your humanity intact. And for me, that was necessary at this time. I might make a different choice in a different setting. You know, I don't know, but I see my role as to be a truth teller, to say, this is how it might play out. You know, Robert, one of the things that you might have seen in another post is I actually said specifically that you might get more callbacks if your name is Lynn or if it's rather than Taylin. I actually mm-hmm. had someone who I had to talk, who I said, listen, if you go by your initial first, Taylin, you're going to get more responses. I didn't say do it. I'm telling you that if you do it, here's what will happen. You have to decide for yourself. My name is Efi. I'm not changing my name. I refuse to do that. But that's a personal choice. It's not a judgment. But I believe the role that I can play, that my team can play, the Alpha Walker Group can play, is to say, just to say the thing. To say the thing. Here is how this will play out. Here's what the research says. If your name is this, if you are a person of color, I can tell a CEO, listen, you said the salary range was 150 to 225. This candidate told you their requirement was $200,000. Now that it is time for the offer stage, you are offering them 150. What changed? You knew their requirements. You said the range was up to 225. Why are you giving? Why are you offering them the lowest number? And helping them see that something unconsciously, I will assume, good, you know, somewhat of a good, you know, positive intention here, that it was not with ill intent, something in your mind associates a leader of color with lesser value.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. Would you offer, if this was a white male candidate, would you offer him 150? No?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then. So you need to give him 200,000. You knew that was his number. It's within your range. Offer him what he asked for. Does that make sense in terms of how we're trying to attack it from different angles?
Mm-hmm. No, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I have a quick question for you.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about, like, salary, and you were discussing, like, how this happens. How do you think people respond to you when you challenge them and you challenge the status quo? And, like, what has the response been, you know, because that takes courage, you know, and it takes courage for a leader of color to ask for a number that they feel like, you know, oh, let me just get in the door first and then hopefully
right.
I can build my salary. So, you know, it to me, someone who's been a part of, you know, executive searches, and it feels encouraging to know that you're on the other side rooting for us. But how do you handle that? And what has a conversation where that has occurred look like? Can you walk us through that conversation?
Sure. So, and I'm thinking of one particular instance. In that particular conversation, a woman on my team who was working very closely with this leader had to just lay out the facts. So what we've discovered is that, like all of us, if you hold up a mirror, it's hard to argue with what you see. This is what happened. Mm. So on this date, you told us the range was this. On this date, the individual said that their number was this. When it came time to offer, the finalist is an African American. When it came time to make an offer, here's what you offered. Now you want to go back and ask, and this literally happened. The CEO said, I want to go and ask him how much he makes right now. We said, that's irrelevant. And also we want you to
Hello.
Know that doing that perpetuates inequity. And here's why. Women of all races, leaders, you know, men of color are consistently underpaid. And so if you are basing a current salary on someone's previous salary, you are basing it on inequity and you are perpetuating that inequity, and that's not who you are. And so oftentimes we also have to appeal, you know, to their better angels, say, that's not who you are. That's not what this organization stands for. And that is usually just laying out the fact pattern. It's not saying, you're a white supremacist. It's not saying you're racist. It's not saying right. any, you just, that's not effective. It's just not. What is effective is laying out the facts and saying, here's what we see transpiring. You are better mm-hmm. than this. And then sometimes having to say, you know, there's another organization we worked with where they wanted to bring this candidate in. It was a woman of color. And over again for more conversation to ask her the same question in a different form. And I finally said, it ends today. You asked this question. It has been asked and answered 3 times. Mm. This is evidence of prove it again. And the CEO started to argue with me. I'm going to go back, and I'm not going to argue with you. During the first round interview, this was the question that was asked. Here's how she answered it. In the second round interview, here's how the question was asked. Here's how she answered it. This is the answer she has. So either you want a different response, or you don't like her response, but asking her the question again isn't going to change her response. And then also being able to cite to research from Google and being able to say Google has discovered with their massive amounts of data that interviews after interview number 4 basically are you're operating with diminishing returns, that they do not produce any additional value, and saying we are already at interview number 4. So make your decision. If you don't want to hire her, you don't want to hire her, but bringing her in again doesn't add any additional value. So that's how we sort of walk the path. And we're not for everybody. To be very clear, we tell clients up front that, and we use this language, we say we are not the help. So if you are looking for that, we are not the firm for you. We're not the firm
right.
for
Come
you.
Come on, Easy. Come on, Easy.
Right.
Come
mean,
on, Easy.
We are not the
We're
help.
We're going to see so Black Panther tonight.
Right.
You talking like that. Come on, Easy.
Listen. Happy Wakanda Week. Happy Wakanda Week.
Right.
So, and then taking your work, looking at your work in that way, you're an ally for your not only your clients, but for the folks that they're looking to hire. Like you're the ally between the two. Can you tell us a time that you've unexpectedly had someone show up as an ally for you, someone who isn't of color, show up and you say either someone stepped in the gap and told them what they needed to hear, or just unexpectedly you did not know that that person had that mindset. Can you give us an example of that?
So, you know, I thought about this, in addition to just like sort of thinking about this, there have been quite a few, honestly. There have been quite a few individuals who have stood in the gap. And I take this all the way back to my early years in school. You know, I had a woman who I reported to her when I was in college, and I, you know, had a work study, and she was constantly advocating for me. I remember applying for law school and admittedly setting my sights, I thought it was being reasonable. And she said, she's like, show me your list of schools where you're applying. And mm-hmm. I didn't have any Ivy League schools. And she said, this is unacceptable. She said, you should be applying to this school and this school and this school. And if you don't have the money to pay for the application fees, I will pay for them. And that was just, that's what she did. She said, this is how you do it. And if you need to advocate or you don't have the money to do something, this is how you do it. If you don't get in, you can still, you don't take that no as a no. You can go to Columbia and petition them and tell them, here's what I'm doing, here's who I am, here's why you should reconsider. You know, ultimately I made a different choice, et cetera, but that advocacy at a very young age in some ways doesn't, I'm probably maybe less surprised in some ways by it, because a number of people have stepped in that way to say, you need to push for more. I remember another woman who had been a partner. I'm thinking of one woman, Deborah, I'll just name her, she's amazing, Deborah Sonkin, who was a former partner at a major search firm. And I was talking to her about a search that I was considering. And something in the way I was communicating to her communicated self-doubt. She said, Ify, it sounds like you are trying to give them reasons not to hire your firm. Let them make that choice. And here's what you tell them. If you want this engagement, here's what you need to say, right? And so she was coaching, and I didn't ask for coaching, but in that moment, she was stepping in and saying, here's what I'm hearing. And so that ability to just give advice, even if I haven't asked for it, to me is a form of allyship and a form of advocacy. You don't have to give it to me. She could have listened to me and said nothing at all, but there have been people like that at different junctures who said, you need to push for more, you need to be on this board, you need to do this. A former boss of mine at Teach for America, Eric Scroggins, another major advocate for me at every turn. So I've been fortunate that I feel like I have a lot of, I've had some terrific allies who have not been of color who have stepped up and said, Efi should be here. She needs to be in this room, either to someone else or to me specifically, and saying, you need to get yourself into this room.
Absolutely. Efi, I feel like we're connected in so many different ways. Full disclosure. I'm Charlotte OA, so I did the core back in 2008. I know Eric. I know Deborah as well. It's so crazy. So it's so amazing that we have these connections and you're doing these outstanding things. I have a question for you. I want to get ready and wrap it up, but I want to ask you, when you think about all you've done and all you've seen, We're gonna have a lot of people listening to this who look in the mirror and, you know, they're people of color, and hopefully there will be some individuals who are not people of color as well. But when you look in the mirror and you hear these people talking, what do you want to tell them? How do you want to tell them to operate in terms of moving forward? What should they tell these executives who interview them at these lead companies? How should they walk in the door? And if you could say anything to them, what would you say? What is your lasting message to them?
My parting message to them would be, wherever you are, you deserve to be. So when you start from that place of, I deserve to be here, you walk in the room differently. You don't think to yourself, well, I can't ask. I need to wait until I get my foot in the door before I can ask for this. You start from a place of, I have tremendous value, and I'm here to shine. Now, recognizing that for some people, your confidence will be tagged as arrogance. And so there's a way to navigate and to do that dance and to use humor and other strategies to lower the defenses of others. But I have found that if you start from that as a place of everywhere that you are, you deserve to be, the way that you show up is different. And the other thing that I would just sort of add to that is to say, and even if it doesn't work out, right, there have been instances where something hasn't worked out the way that I'd wanted it to, or I'd showed up for, you know, a particular engagement and I wanted this engagement and it didn't work out. But I could still be proud of the way that I showed up, that I was going to leave a message about who I am, who we are as a firm, what we stand for, and you're going to remember me, right? It might not be today. You might not be ready for what we are doing today, but you will be very clear about the value that we add, and when you're ready, I will be here. And that's happened in multiple situations where it wasn't right. They were not ready for sort of the way that we operate, but they were a year from now. And it was what they remembered from that experience that made them say, you know what, I remember this conversation and that was really tough for me to hear. And I felt admittedly a certain way about you when I first encountered and worked with you, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But now we're ready, I think, differently. So that would be my parting message.
Awesome.
Well,
Efi, we truly appreciate your time, your wisdom, everything that you've offered here, everything that you offer online, and in the words of Dear Black Women, we're going to continue to follow you, continue to share your words of wisdom, and there's nothing more that, if there's anything else that you think that you want to add, we'll make sure we catch it online. Robert? Thank you.
Right?
Thank you.
And Evie, I just want to say again, thank you for your time. We appreciate you, and we cannot wait for everyone to hear this outstanding message that you have for them. I feel like you took us to church a little bit, so we're going to. If we had some people here, we would definitely pass the collection plate.
You both are so kind. Thank you both so much for having me. I've enjoyed myself. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Black Work Experience podcast. Your support and engagement has helped us surpass our wildest dreams in week one. A special shout out to Naomi Shelton for joining us on this episode and to our sound engineer, Sarah Dackett. None of this is possible without your help. Make sure you all follow us on Twitter at BWE Podcast and on IG at BWE Pod. If you want to send us a submission for mail time, feel free to email us at blackworkexperiencepod@gmail.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
Domino, domino, only spot a few blacks behind you. Domino, domino, only spot a few blacks behind you.